Guardian Unlimited.
I'm James Randerson, and this is Science Extra from Guardian Unlimited. This is an extended interview between Dr. Susan Blackmore and the leading philosopher, Professor Daniel Dennett of Tufts University. The interview forms part of Susan's book, Conversations on Consciousness, and the conversation begins with Susan asking Professor Dennett about the fundamentals of the consciousness debate.
Consciousness seems to be some kind of worse problem than many other problems in science. Why? Let me put it another way. Dave Chalmers says there's a hard problem. William James says there's a fathomless abyss. Is there really a problem? If it's not that problem, what is it?
I think the reason that we find consciousness so hard is that we have evolved to have a certain capacity for self-knowledge, certain access to ourselves, which gives us subjective experience, which gives us a way of looking out at the world from where we are. And this just turns out to be very hard to understand, how something can have that perspective and not be just a thing, but a thing with a point of view and with the capacity to reflect on that point of view and talk about it. And it looks as if each one of us is in a certain sense trapped within a point of view. I can't ever get inside your head and you can't ever get inside mine. And this fact, and there is some sense which it is just undeniably a fact that we have these perspectives, is not closely paralleled with anything else we know about anything else. It isn't that atoms have that sort of thing, or that molecules, or that volcanoes, or continents, or trees, or galaxies. The only thing we know in the whole universe that has this feature is ourselves. And we're not even sure about each other. That's the problem of other minds. It is an artifact, I think, in a good sense of artifact. There's also bad senses of that term. It's something we've made, something that's been made in us, and something that we are these artifacts. We have been created by the process of evolution, both genetic and cultural, so that this is true of us. And what we're now trying to do is to reverse engineer ourselves, to understand what on earth it is, what kind of a machine are we, that this can be true of us. We don't know any other machines that have this feature.
But are you equating subjective experience with having a point of view?
Having a point of view is not a simple matter. There's an easy sense of having a point of view where lobsters have a point of view,
yeah,
and mosquitoes have a point of view. With a little stretching and pulling, you might even say that a pine tree had a point of view. That is to say, a pine tree, to take this sort of worst case, responds to the world selectively. There's only some features of the environment around the pine tree that it is sensitive to. And it is sensitive to them for usually pretty good reasons. And the rest of the world is indiscernible, as it were, by the pine tree. But that's indiscernible, as it were. In our case, there's real discerning. Real discerning, in the eyes of many people who have thought about it, has got to be worlds away from the sort of discriminative capacities of that pine tree or that mosquito. And this creates an artifact in the bad sense of the imaginative chasms with our real discerning and our real points of view and the mere robots and discriminating but not sentient things. That's the way it seems to many people. I think that the gap between me and a pine tree or me and a mosquito is huge, but it's traversable by a series of steps, and there's nothing imponderable or utterly mysterious about it. But I do have to say that the steps are, some of them, quite counterintuitive, and there's not yet in place the sort of firm take-it-or-leave-it science that can force people to abandon those intuitions. Right now, it's a struggle to get people even to think about abandoning their intuitions. I think the big problem for people working in consciousness is they have these powerful, seductive intuitions about how it has to be or how it can't be that are just wrong. Nothing new there. We've always had false intuitions about the way the world is, and counterintuitive science has come along and changed them. But in this case, we don't yet know, although some of us have very strongly held beliefs, about which intuitions to abandon and why. And so the problem is very much a problem of persuasion and self-persuasion and a sort of self-manipulation of one's own imagination, which is scary to many people and dubious to many people. And so instead what they do is they try to have a theory which doesn't require them to tweak their intuitions at all. And then they end up down one cul-de-sac or another, because the theories that are not counterintuitive are just wrong.
I imagine that in your mind here may be the zombie hunch.
Yes, or as I call it, the zombic hunch. The zombic hunch is the idea that there could be a being that behaved exactly the way you or I behave in every regard, could, you know, cry at sad movies and be thrilled by joyous sunsets and enjoy ice cream and the whole thing, and yet be not be conscious at all, just be a zombie. Now, I think that many people are sure that hunch is right, and they don't know why they're sure. If you point out to them that the arguments for taking zombies seriously or the zombie kind of seriously are all flawed, this doesn't stop them from clinging to the hunch. They are afraid to let go of it for fear they're leaving something deeply important out. And so we get a bifurcation of theorists into those who take the zombie hunch seriously and those who, like myself, have sort of overcome it. I can feel it, but I just don't credit it.
What is this fear of letting go of the zombie hunch, even for people who might rationally understand the arguments for getting rid of it?
I think the fear is that they're afraid that zombies would have no moral significance. Zombies would be just stuff. And you can chop stuff up, break stuff up, throw it away, burn it, whatever, it doesn't make any difference, it's just stuff. If we're zombies, then we're just robots, or we just, you know, take it apart, it doesn't matter. Whereas if we have souls, if we have immortal souls, or anything that's the sort of moral equivalent of that, then we preserve our moral point of view. I think the idea of a soul is a sort of curious fossil trace of the desire to treat ourselves as absolute in some way.
Is it more about morality and mattering, that it matters to something or someone or, you know, the universe, what we do, or is it more about that we want to survive?
Well, I think those two are intertwined. I think that the great inversion of Darwin, what Mackenzie called his strange inversion of reasoning, was when Darwin realized that you have a bottom-up theory of creativity, that all the wonderful design that we see in the biosphere could be the products, direct and indirect, of a mindless, purposeless process. And this simply inverts an idea that I think is as old as our species, maybe older in a certain sense, and that is what you might call the top-down theory of creativity. It takes a big fancy thing to make a less fancy thing. Potters make pots. You never see a pot making a potter. You never see a horseshoe making a blacksmith. It's always big, fancy, wise, wonderful things making lesser things. And so here we are. We're pretty wonderful. We must be made by something more wonderful still, and it's got to be like us. It's got to be the intelligent artificer. That's very scary for people to give that up and to begin to think about how our importance doesn't depend on the importance of something still more important. that is not of that sort. I mean, I think on the one hand, I think that a good bumper sticker recipe for happiness is find something more important than yourself to think about and work about and worry about. There are many such things that we can find to replace the one big important thing which many people think they have to have, which is God.
You're very hard there on the first person point of view, and change blindness is of course a good example there, because we wouldn't have discovered it without the experiments, or at least we wouldn't have confirmed it without the experiments. But can you see no role for disciplined self-observation? I'm thinking in particular of things like meditation, where it's said if you keep at it long enough, some of these things become obvious. They start to disintegrate. The illusions that we are merely under of continuity, of self, of the world out there, of simultaneity, of stimuli that we can judge, these things start to fall apart and you see more clearly. Do you think there's any truth in that, or do you dismiss that completely?
No, I think there is truth in it, but I think that this is, as one used to say, in the context of discovery, not the context of justification. Every experimenter should, of course, put herself in the apparatus and see what it's like from the inside. If you're doing experiments on anything, psychophysics or neuropsychology or any of these things, you should certainly treat yourself informally as a subject and see if you've overlooked something, for instance. But of course, having done that, then you do the experiment. And then you use naive subjects. Then you figure out some way to get what you've discovered from the first person point of view to manifest itself for neutral observers from the third person point of view. And if you can't do that, then you have to be suspicious of the insights that you thought you got. Now, in a sense, this is obvious and everybody's known it for years. I can think of nobody in the scientific world working on consciousness who would think of submitting a paper that said, well, I introspected under the following circumstances and these are the things that I found. Hey, you got to be kidding us. You might discover a phenomenon. That is, you discover enough of a phenomenon so then you can go out and test it to make sure you'd actually discovered it. But of course you have to use scientific method, and that means third person point of view, to confirm what you've discovered. This would be just a typical philosopher's hypersensitivity to form and rigor to which philosophers are prone, if it weren't for the fact that we have so many cases where people are just wrong about the results of their own introspection. It's been a hugely misleading beacon over the centuries. People cannot prevent themselves from theorizing when they think they're observing. And their auto-psychology theories are just bad.
I'm particularly interested here in what I think is one of your central arguments, the non-existence of the Cartesian theater. So you explain why there can't be a Cartesian theater and why there isn't a show going on and there isn't somebody observing it. And you call people who still get trapped in the Cartesian theatre, Cartesian materialists. Can you say something about what for you are the signs of being a Cartesian materialist and how common they are and anything else about it, really?
The sure signs of Cartesian materialism is anybody who tells the story of consciousness and doesn't go on and answer the "and then what happens" question. So that it's as if we work so hard to get this stuff up and present it to the Queen, and then what happens? We got inside the audience chamber, but why does that make it consciousness? And a curious feature of this is that a lot of theorists, if you then go on and answer the "and then what happens" question, they're sure that you've left it out. You've left the consciousness out, because now we're back explaining behaviors and reactions and effects on vocalization and memory and all that. And wait a minute, where's the consciousness? It's still got a place for the show to happen, has not yet done the job. There's this sort of wonderful bimodal distribution between people who think that any theory of consciousness that leaves out the first person is a hopeless theory. any theory of consciousness that doesn't leave out the first person is a hopeless theory. You've got to leave the first person out of your final theory. You won't have a theory of consciousness if you still have the first person in there, because that was what it was your job to explain. And what that means is that all the paraphernalia that doesn't make any sense unless you've still got a first person in there has to be turned into something else. You've got to figure out some way to break it up and distribute its powers and opportunities into the system in some other way. The Cartesian materialist is the one who describes large parts of the machine, but it's still inhabited.
A lot of your ideas you really had a very, very long time ago as an undergraduate, and a lot of what you've been doing has really been fleshing that out and explaining it. But has there been anything that's happened in your life as a philosopher of consciousness that's really changed your life or your way you feel about yourself?
I haven't had any conversion experiences that I can think of, but I certainly think the cumulative effect of a lot of interactions with people outside philosophy have had a huge effect. Probably the first 5 years of my career back in the late 60s, I was still sort of hanging out 99% of the time with philosophers, going to philosophy meetings, reading philosophy journals, talking to philosophers. And a rather small percentage of my time, but a cherished and fascinated percentage of the time, I spent talking to people in other disciplines. And I gradually came to realize that my sort of dirty little secret was I found that more interesting than talking to the philosopher. I learned more, and I found it philosophically more interesting. I got more philosophical thought. I got more ideas from talking to people in artificial intelligence, biology, neuroscience, psychology, than I did talking with my fellow philosophers. And so over the years, I went where the fun was for me, and it fed on itself, and it meant that I got invited to more and more non-philosophical occasions and conferences, and I read more and more articles and books, to the point now where I make myself read the philosophy that's relevant to what I'm working on. And I find value there too. But that's duty. And I have to work at it. And it staggers me to realize how much less fun it is to read most philosophy than it is to read good biology or good psychology or good artificial intelligence. So that's made a huge difference to me. And of course, what this means is there are a lot of people in the field of philosophy who just say, well, you know, Dennis is no longer a philosopher. He may have been a philosopher at once, but he isn't now. Well, I don't want to argue with him about that, but if so, then maybe all philosophers should cease being philosophers and try to do the sort of thing that I'm doing. Because I think, first of all, I think I'm getting philosophical results. I think I'm making philosophical progress. I think my views are it's more philosophy than anything else. And I also think it's better than the sort of in a vacuum philosophy that we all used to engage in. Philosophy is what you do when you don't yet know what the right questions to ask are.
That was Dr. Susan Blackmore speaking with Professor Daniel Dennett. You can find more at Susan's website, susanblackmore.co.uk, while for more interviews like this and the very best news and analysis of the worlds of science and technology, make sure you listen to our Science Weekly podcast. Head to guardian.co.uk/science.
Guardian Unlimited.